skies for amber waves
of... Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Well, hopefully this evening, for the first hour, we're going to have our open line program for the second hour. But this evening, over hopefully the first hour, we're going to have Jesse Trentadue on the line. And Jesse is an attorney whose brother was beaten to death in a federal prison in Oklahoma just about the time of the Timothy McVeigh trial, and perhaps just before or after Timothy McVeigh was executed. And the government covered up for this. The government denied that anything had happened to the brother. It said it was a suicide. And when it became obvious that the man was beaten to death in an American federal prison, the case went to court, and the settlement of multi-million dollars. I don't know how many million dollars settlement it was, but it was a multi-million dollar settlement. Do you remember when that hit the headlines across America? I mean, have you heard anything about it on 2020 or 60 Minutes or about the fact that a man was beaten to death by federal officials in a federal court, a federal prison in the United States? His name was Trentadue, and of course, he was in there on a minor. He had actually was out on parole. He had a parole violation. But why did they beat him to death? Well, apparently, it all had to do with what really happened in Oklahoma City, and you've never heard the true story of Oklahoma City. And the government to this very day has the videotapes that were shot in front of the Murrah Building back there in 1995, and on April 19th, 1995. And they refused to release them. And you know why? Because there's an ongoing investigation. Oh, we can't let anybody see that. Why? We couldn't want the criminals to know that we were still investigating what really happened. And the truth of the matter is, they are lying to the American people, and they have lied about what happened in Oklahoma City, and they lied about the fact that they had prior knowledge, and they lied about the fact that what brought the building down was not the bomb in the Ryder truck, but internal explosions. And this is the most incredible story. I mean, obviously there was a John Doe 2 and 3 and 4. There was a John Doe 1 who was in the truck with Timothy McVeigh. The government knows who he was. He was an Iraqi. He was part of an Iraqi cell of Iraqis who had been brought to the United States after the first Gulf War. And they've been protected by the government because they can't let the American people know the truth about what happened. You see, if they could get away with the bombing of the Murrah Building, they'd be able to get away with something much larger. They would be able to control the reality of the American people. And I believe that what happened there was certainly a forerunner of what was to happen on September 11th, 2001. Well, it sounds as if we're not going to be able to get our guest this evening. I'm not certain exactly why, but it may very well be that we'll be doing open lines the first hour. So right now, we're going to suggest that I'm going to play a little. All right, fine. Well, anyway, I don't seem to be able to be getting our guest. I'm going to play a little music here for a moment and just see if I can come up with anything that'll help us to get our guest here. So you just hang on there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess we're going to have open lines there the first hour here. So if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll have 2 hours of open lines tonight. But I wanted to go on a little on with this story of Jesse Tretadeau. Jesse Tretadeau, after his brother was murdered by government officials and totally covered up by the media, even though the family was given a multi-million dollar settlement, why Jesse Tretadeau has been trying to determine what this was all about. And so through a series of Freedom of Information requests, he's gotten a great deal of information. And the fact is that Timothy McVeigh was tied into a number of people who were associated with the Aryan Nation movement. They were associated with bank robbers, and they were raising money for a revolution here in the United States. But what nobody understands is that Timmy McVeigh was part of a special forces team that engaged in illegal activity. Now, Jesse Tretadeau now has come across the man who is in the cell next to Timothy McVeigh, a man named John Paul Hammer, H-A-M-M-E-R, who wrote a book, and it's called Something Worth Dying For. Somebody else wrote it. Hammer is in prison. He's scheduled to be executed, but the federal government put Hammer in the cell next to Timothy McVeigh and then recorded their conversations. And Timothy McVeigh told Hammer that he had been contacted by a four-man special forces team, a renegade special forces team, and they were intimately involved in what happened. Now, that certainly goes along with the material that we've gotten from other sources. Jim Keith has written a book called OK Bomb, going into the background of what happened in Oklahoma City, and commented that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister Jennifer saying that she was not to tell anybody, but he was part of a special forces team that was engaged in illegal activity. And of course, Charles Key, who I trust explicitly, who certainly has led the investigation of private citizens in Oklahoma City, says that he has a copy of the letter and he's promised to get me a copy. I've not yet seen it. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our special guest this evening, I don't know quite why we haven't been able to reach him, but under any circumstances, we're going to have open lines. I guess we're going to have open lines for 2 hours. So if you'd like to give us a call, the number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I was covering some of what we would have covered with Jesse Tretadeau here this evening. And, of course, as you know, his brother was murdered in a federal prison, beaten to death. Nobody has ever been chided. Nobody has ever been demoted. Nobody has ever been, called before the bar of justice for murdering a man in prison. And for the government effort to cover up this, because, you see, it was much larger than simply Jesse Tretadeau's brother. This tied into the whole Oklahoma City bombing cover-up. And the fact that Timothy McVeigh was actually part of a special forces team involved in illegal activity. Why do I say that? Well, of course, number one is because there was a letter supposedly written by Timothy McVeigh to his sister Jennifer saying he was part of a special forces team involved in illegal activity. Jim Keith wrote about that in a book called OK Bomb. Jim Keith died very strangely after a minor orthopedic procedure, and I've done literally thousands of them and never had a complication, but Jim Keith died, and that could have been just an accident. Those things do happen, pulmonary embolus. But then a few months later, his publisher died under strange circumstances, and then very shortly after that, Jim Keith's ex-wife dies under strange circumstances. All of that could be just coincidental. Maybe there never was a letter except Charles Key, former representative to the legislature in Oklahoma, assures me he's seen the letter, he has a copy of the letter, and he promised to get me a copy. But then, of course, what was so interesting about the guest we were to have had this evening, Jesse Tretadeau, is a lawyer who's been investigating this, is the fact that he is representing a man whose name is Hammer, H-A-M-M-E-R, or AR, I'm not certain which, who's written a book, I think it's something like Something Worth Dying For, or Some Things Worth Dying For. It was co-written with another one. Hammer's in prison. He's there, on death row in maximum security. But he wrote this book based upon his conversations with Timothy McVeigh, which tell essentially the same story. And talked to Jesse Trentadon, who acknowledges the fact that he had certainly believes that Hammer is telling the truth. He has no reason to lie. He's facing, of course, a death penalty. But the thing is that Timothy McVeigh had actually told Hammer that he was part of a special forces team, and there was a man, there was somebody known as the Major and three other people in this team who worked with him on the bombing. Now, the FBI has the tapes of the conversations, and Jesse Trentadon is trying to get his hands on those tapes. Why is the Federal Bureau of Investigation concealing the truth about Timothy McVeigh? Why are they still concealing the tapes of a shot out in front of the Murrah Building on April 19, 1995? Why have they repeatedly denied that there was any relationship between Timothy McVeigh and the Elohim City when Jesse Trentadon has been able to get Freedom of Information Act releases that shows that Timothy McVeigh actually visited Elohim City? And you must understand that Elohim City was a Christian identity enclave. Christian identity is supposedly a violently anti-Semitic, militant sort of Aryan nation group that is inhabited by people who are vicious and hate-filled. And in fact, Janet Reno talked about in one of her directives on the terrorism and hate groups, she cited Christian identity as a sort of prototype of this. The only trouble is that almost everybody at the Christian identity camp at Elohim City, at least all the names I know, were government agents. I mean, Reverend Millar, who ran the camp, testified under oath, at the Carol Howe trial that he was an FBI informant. He ran the camp. He ran this whole racist anti-Semitic organization. And then, of course, Carol Howe, who was there, and Andy Strassmeyer, and there were others there. And they were all working for different government agencies. In fact, the BATF at one time wanted to raid the camp because they knew they were planning to blow up the Murrah Building, and the Justice Department intervened and stopped the raid. What sort of madness is this? And a lot of this is told in a book by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, that he was the senior reporter from the London Times, who was here for a period of time and really did some excellent work. I think it was called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. If you haven't read Ambrose Evans Pritchard's book, it's well worthwhile getting. And certainly we have a four-tape set on Oklahoma City with my interviews with Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who talks about his conversations with a man named Andy Strassmeyer, who was, of course, one of the major agitators at Elohim City, was obviously an intelligence agent sent there as an agent provocateur to encourage bombings and things of that sort. His father was involved with German intelligence. He was obviously working for an intelligence agency of some sort. And I mean, I followed this whole incredible story of Andy Strassmeyer, who was smuggled out of the country and got back to Germany. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard, and you can hear my interview with him, talks about how he finally tracks down Strassmeyer by phone and says, "Strassmeyer, why don't you tell the American people the truth about what happened at Oklahoma City? Why don't you tell them maybe it was an operation that just went wrong? It wasn't supposed to be there. It was a sting operation. It went bad." And according to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who I have every reason to believe, Strassmeyer said, "You don't understand. The American people could not accept the truth. The American people could not accept the truth." So the tape, you can hear my interview with Ambrose Evans Pritchard. I believe it's in my Oklahoma City four-tape set. That's the update. We have actually two tape sets. But this is the second one, and it's so important. You understand, we've been lied to about Oklahoma City. We've been lied to about John Doe 2 and 3 and 4, because they were part of an Iraqi cell that was there in Oklahoma City. And in fact, we actually have a video, and if you haven't yet seen it, you should. It's called Jihad in America. And you will see there, and I think these films were probably shot by the FBI, but back in 1988, Abdullah Azzam was in Oklahoma City. And Abdullah Azzam was, Abdullah Azzam was actually the man who organized Al-Qaeda. And he is actually talking, because he's talking in Arabic, but it's being translated for us. He's talking about how, you know, they're going to have to lop off hands and feet so that Allah will have feet to stand on, and so the blood is going to have to run on the streets of America. Now, this is Oklahoma City. This is where this other terrorist cell was, and the FBI knew all about it. In fact, the FBI has thoroughly infiltrated all of these organizations. You remember right after 9/11, we were told, oh, the FBI, you know, could not infiltrate the Muslim groups because they were so tight-knit. We had no way to infiltrate them. And yet, immediately after 9/11, they arrested 1,000 Muslims who were in this country. Some of them were here illegally, that come in and overstayed their visas. If we had no way of knowing what was going on, how were we able to arrest 1,000 people immediately? And then, of course, we were told, oh, the intelligence agencies had no possible way of tracking Osama bin Laden. You know, there was no way to get close to him. And yet, Johnny Lynn Walker, this young man who converted to Islam from up around Santa Rosa, was able to go over and meet with Osama bin Laden a couple of times. How could Johnny Lynn Walker have been so much smarter than our entire intelligence agencies? And I'd like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, they're not telling us the truth. We're consistently lied to. And this is why we need methods of finding out what's really going on. Because believe me, if we don't get to the bottom of what happened in Oklahoma City, and we don't get to the bottom of what happened on 9/11, we're going to be in a war with the entire Muslim world that is totally unnecessary. And with that as the background, let's get to our special guest, Jesse Trentadeau. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Why don't you sort of tell us just a little bit about, my listeners who don't know who you are, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself? You're a lawyer. You're the brother your brother was killed, and why don't you give the story of his murder by government agents, and none of them have ever been punished or even chastised for killing a helpless man in prison?
It was a torture killing. What happened, and at the time it happened, my brother Kenny, we didn't understand or know what we know now, but he supposedly was, he had gotten out of the military during the Vietnam War as a heroin addict. And that was not uncommon at that time. And to support his habit, he robbed a bank, and he was caught, and he pled guilty, and he went and he did his time. He was paroled in the late 1980s, married, and then suddenly picked up in 1995 and sent to Oklahoma from San Diego, California, and was dead 2 days later. He had been beaten head to toe. His head had been smashed in three places all the way to the skull, and his throat had been slashed. And the United States government, especially the FBI, said it was a suicide by hanging. And we fought them and fought them and fought them on that. And, of course, didn't understand at the time why they threw an army of attorneys at us. I think at one time they had 12 law firms hired to fight us, in addition to the Department of Justice. By our estimate, they spent close to probably now $15 million fighting us over that, and all we wanted to know was why he was killed. Shortly before he was executed, I received a message from Tim McVeigh, who said, when I saw your brother's picture and heard what happened to him, I knew that the FBI had killed him because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie.
Hold up, we'll be back in just a moment. All right, of course. Now, who is this Richard McGruffy?
Richard Lee Guthrie, I believe now, was the John Doe 2 in the Oklahoma City bombing. He belonged to a group called the Midwest Bank Robbery Gang, who, along with Tim McVeigh and a number of FBI informants, robbed banks and armored cars to get the money to construct the bomb that blew up the Murrow Building and killed 168 people, including 19 toddlers. And McVeigh sent that message to me, and of course, Guthrie supposedly hangs himself while in federal custody. The day before he's supposed to give a tell-all interview, I understand, to 60 Minutes.
All right, fine. So basically, then this got involved. This is sort of an Aryan Nation gang, wasn't it?
It was. And
so they actually thought your brother was this Guthrie because he looked like him.
It did. And when you read the description of John Doe 2 that the FBI had posted when my brother was picked up and murdered, it was the largest manhunt in American history. The description was white male, 5'9", powerful upper body build, dark complected, believed to be driving a mid-1980s Chevrolet pickup, thought to be in Mexico or Canada, and a dragon tattoo left forearm. My brother came across the border from Mexico in San Diego visiting his wife's family. They were Hispanic. Driving his friend's 1986 Chevrolet pickup, 5'9", powerful upper body build, dark complected, dragon tattoo left forearm. The only other person who matched that description was Richard Lee Guthrie. My brother was picked up, sent to Oklahoma, and dead 2 days later.
All right, fine. Well, now, why do you think that they wanted to kill Guthrie? Was he in any way connected to the government, or was he simply, some sort of a right-wing fanatic?
Well, he was a right-wing fanatic, but I sued, to put it in perspective, about 6 months after my brother was murdered, I received an anonymous call that said, your brother was killed because he fit a profile of a group of bank robbers who were robbing banks and armored cars to fund the tax on the federal government. They didn't use the name Midwest Bank Robbery Gang, the caller did. And they didn't mention Guthrie. And the person told me that the interrogation got out of hand. It was a big mistake. It went too far. I dismissed it as a crank, a nut. And that was about January of 1996. My brother was killed shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing. And then in June or July of 1996, I saw and read a Los Angeles Times story talking about Richard Lee Guthrie and his supposed suicide as a member of the Midwest Bank Robbery Gang who had robbed banks to get money to attack the federal government. And then I thought that's a coincidence. And then I didn't pay much attention to it until years later when I said just before he was executed, McVeigh sent me that message. And what I've done since then is I've filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI asking for all records linking them to informants in with McVeigh, both with the Midwest Bank Robbery Gang and as at a white supremacist paramilitary training camp in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City. And apparently Elohim City was established by the FBI, or at least infiltrated heavily, after Waco and Ruby Ridge. The FBI had sustained such incredible...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jesse Trenado, and of course his brother had actually been killed, has been murdered by government officials at a federal penitentiary because they thought he was a man named Guthrie who had been involved with an Aryan Nation gang that had been robbing banks to get money to so they could attack the federal government. And so his brother was beaten to death just as a case of mistaken identity, but nobody in America has ever been called to task force. And when the president said, we would never condone torture, he just wasn't telling the truth. But now, it didn't happen under his watch. It happened under Clinton's watch. But this thing goes on. It happens not infrequently. I know Congressman George Hansen, who was sent to prison on trumped-up charges and later exonerated. But he told me how he was frequently tortured in prison, intentionally and purposely, just to break his will down. Now, so anyway, of course, this whole thing ties into Elohim City, which is a Christian identity center in the eastern part of Oklahoma, which has actually been heavily infiltrated by the government agents. In fact, everybody whose name is I know of who was there was a government agent working for a different branch of government. And while Janet Reno is condemning the Christian Identity Movement, they're financing the Christian Identity Movement. So pick up the story there, please.
Well, what happened is they decided, I'm convinced, that to restore their image, the lost image they had sustained because of their screw-ups at Waco and Ruby Ridge.
You're talking about the FBI.
The FBI. They were going to establish a sting operation at Elohim City. And they were going to lure in all of these neo-Nazis and white supremacists and militia types under the pretense of teaching them how to arm themselves and to attack the federal government. And one of their informants there was the explosives instructor who actually taught McVeigh and the others how to build a bomb. So they had informants in with the bank robbers. There were two components to this operation, the bank robbers and the Elohim City. So the FBI had informants with the bank robbers who were robbing banks and armored cars with Tim McVeigh to get the money to construct the bomb, and then informants at Elohim City who were teaching them how to make the bomb.
I know. Was that Strassmeyer? Who was
that? Was Strassmeyer.
Okay, fine. Now, that was the German whose father was in German intelligence and who was obviously working for someone of our intelligence agencies.
And they smuggled him out of the country after the FBI right. did after the bomb went off. But they knew, and so I sued them, the FBI, under the Freedom of Information Act for documents linking them to this operation. And, of course, I knew they would lie to me.
The thing that is so disturbing, Jesse, is the fact that the government lies. And government agents can lie and lie and lie. And nothing is ever done to government agents who lie. But if you lie to a federal official, why, they'll send you to prison. But they are deceiving the American people about what really happened. And they're still deceiving it. And this goes right up to Washington, D.C.
It goes to the heart of the... It goes to the Clinton-Reno Justice Department and the White House. After, I don't think that the Clintons necessarily were involved in the operation, but once it went terribly wrong for them, once the bomb went off, it was the cover-up was run out of the White House. But in terms of lying, it has proved to be an asset to me because I've always... There's one constant I could count on would be the FBI would lie. It would lie when the truth would serve it better. And so I had been leaked two memos from former FBI Director Louis Freeh talking about the informants at Elohim City, talking about McVeigh calling there 2 weeks before the bombing, asking for help to carry out the attack on the Murrow Building. And so when I filed my suit and asked for these documents, of course, the FBI came back and lied and said they didn't exist. Well, then I filed those two documents I had.
Now, do you know who sent them to you?
I don't.
All right, fine. But anyway, they
said they came out. They're from an FBI source.
All right, fine. There are a lot of good people, I'm sure, in the FBI who want to get the truth out.
They're not all evil.
And I've actually had documents leaked to me by government officials as well who try to get the truth out to the American people, but they know they won't get it out through the controlled media. So pick the story up there.
Well, so I knew that they would lie. So once they did, I knew I had them. So I filed those two documents in court, and of course they came back and said they were frauds, they were forgeries, they were fakes. I had waiting for them an affidavit from a retired FBI agent who'd worked down at the Bureau headquarters in Washington, D.C., who said, no, I've looked at these teletypes, they're real. And of course by then the judge had it with the FBI, and he ordered them to go back and do a manual search and to turn over to me the documents linking them to this sting operation into the bombing of the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. And they, interestingly, they came back and said they had found 340 documents. Then they come back and tell the judge they'd only found 17, that there were actually the 340, they just were duplicates of the 17 they had. They begged the judge not to turn them over. And my big fear is there are two, when you sue under the Freedom of Information Act.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Jesse Trentino. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what we're up against. We've got dishonest people in high positions in government. Well, go right ahead, Jesse. Pick the story up from there.
Well, the one thing I thought they would do all along is tell the federal judge that I was crazy as a bedbug. And you would think that the accusations I made against the FBI were horrible, that they had known in advance about the bombing and had not stopped it. Their informants had actually helped fund the bombing, and it even taught McVeigh how to help construct the bomb and the bombing, and had murdered my brother, thinking he was Richard Lee Guthrie. You would think that if I had accused you of that, you would have denied it. Not one denial from the FBI. And my fear was, under the Freedom of Information Act, there are two exemptions the FBI can trigger when I can't get the records. The first one is to say that there's an ongoing criminal investigation, and if you turn over those documents to me, it will interfere with that investigation. I thought for sure they would come back and announce they'd reopen the bombing investigation, and that would have shut me down. I wouldn't have gotten anything. But they didn't do that. The second exemption, and to me the more telling, is if you're dealing with an informant, and if the FBI has promised that informant anonymity, you can't have the name. And that's what they did. They came back to this judge and said, "Judge, we had four informants in with McVeigh in Adelaham City. We had promised them anonymity. You can't turn over those records." And the judge says, "Wait a minute. I can't turn over their names. You can black the names out, but you turn over the documents." The names blacked out. And that's exactly what they were required to do. And it shows they did, in fact, have four informants. They did, in fact, know in advance, months in advance, of the plan to blow up the Murrow Building. In fact, one of the informants had told them that they, of the plan to blow up the Murrow Building in the fall of 1994, and this informant had actually toured the target, the Murrow Building, with McVeigh and the others who had carried out that attack. It wasn't just McVeigh and Nichols. There are at least a dozen people who were involved in that who are still walking the streets today because the FBI doesn't dare go after them for fear that it will expose their prior knowledge.
And the fact that they knew ahead of time what was going to happen and they left the people there to die.
Exactly. And worse than that, they helped plan it. To my mind, if your informants funded by robbing banks and teach McVeigh how to make the bomb and actually help him construct the bomb, you did it.
And that's really a rather frightening thing to contemplate, but we've seen the same pattern over and over again. We'll talk a little bit more about that perhaps on another occasion. I'd simply mention the first World Trade Center bombing. Be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Jesse Trentadue. And basically, through a series of requests for a freedom of under the Freedom of Information Act, he has been able to get extensive documents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation that they did not want to turn over. But these documents show that they had at least four informants working with Timothy McVeigh. There were at least probably 10 or more people involved in the conspiracy to blow up the Murrow Building. The government knew about that. They actually taught McVeigh how to build a bomb, didn't they?
They did.
So they taught McVeigh how to build a bomb. Did they help to finance the purchase of the material?
They did, through the robberies of banks and armored cars.
All right, fine. And so, but they can't tell the American people that. Why, we'd begin to lose confidence in them. Now, have you been trying to get this information out to the American people?
I have, and it's not been successful.
The controlled media can't let the American people know the truth about Oklahoma City, because then they'd begin questioning TW-800. They'd begin questioning, maybe they haven't told us the truth, really, about what happened on 9/11.
Well, I think it's an interesting dynamic of the American media, that once the judge ordered these documents released, I have been in contact, directly or indirectly, with 60 Minutes, ABC 2020, every major television media outlet in the country, not local stations, but the national media out of Washington and New York. They all requested those documents. I gladly give them to them. I give them to the world. And I said, why don't you do this story? And without doubt, they all have said, more or less, that they want to be second. That it's so ugly, so horrible, that they don't want to be the first one to tell this story. And interestingly enough, last June, the last of the documents were produced, and I received a call from the BBC, who asked me if they could have copies of them, and I said, certainly. They sent a reporter over here, spent 3 days with me in late June, this last June, going over those documents. And in September, they sent a film crew, not for me, but to the United States for almost a month, to film this story. And I don't know where they went and who all they talked to, but it's my understanding they're going to run it, that the government of the United States had advanced knowledge of the plan to blow up the Murrow Building and actually participated indirectly in it through informants and didn't stop it.
And those informants, of course, are roaming around in the country now scot-free.
They are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this fellow named Hammer. What was his name? Was it John Paul Hammer?
David Paul Hammer.
David Paul Hammer. Well, who is David Paul Hammer? Why is his story important?
David Paul Hammer is probably a tribute to the ineffectiveness and the disastrous penal system we have. An incredibly bright kid out of Oklahoma who got in trouble at 18 and who would escape and taunt the judges to the point where they gave him 300-400 year sentences consecutively. He'd never killed anyone or anything, but he had just stood up to the amount of stupidity that comes with youth. And eventually he sent to federal prison to do his sentence. And I don't know, understand the circumstances of it or the facts around it, but he ended up killing his cellmate and was sentenced to death. And he was on death row with Timothy McVeigh for almost 3 years. And McVeigh, I mean, they were basically cellmates or next door to each other. So over that three-year period, McVeigh told him the story of what happened with the bomb and the others involved.
I wanted just to touch on that, because I think what McVeigh told Hammer is told in a book. What's the title of the book?
Secrets Worth Dying For.
Secrets Worth Dying For. All right, fine. And so what was basically the story that Hammer records?
That there were many other people involved, that the attack was carried out through the Midwest bank robbery gang robberies in which McVeigh participated, and it was carried out of Elohim City, Oklahoma, that McVeigh basically understood that it was a setup and that there was a second Ryder truck that was a decoy truck that lured the FBI away from the planned target. And the plan, I think, in my mind, I think to capitalize off of this, I believe it was the FBI's intent that they would let the plan go as far as possible, stop it at the last possible minute with cameras rolling, and be superheroes. And it got away from them. And once it got away from them, it was, oh my God, we've got to, first comes the screw-up, then comes the cover-up, and that's what happened.
Well, it sort of goes along, at least somewhat, with Ambrose Evans Pritchard's story. I don't know if you know who Pritchard was. He was the senior correspondent for the Sunday Times in Washington, D.C., and he actually talked to Andrew Strassmeyer after Strassmeyer had gotten back to Germany. And he had actually said to Strassmeyer, why don't you come forward and tell the American people what happened? Tell them it was a sting operation that went bad. And Strassmeyer's remark was, the American people couldn't accept the truth. The American people couldn't accept the truth. I can't tell them.
I read that interview, and it was as close to a confession as I've ever seen.
Right. Well, actually, I have a taped interview with Ambrose Evans Pritchard, where he tells the story. And I think it's really one of the great interviews I have on that whole subject, and I've always been fascinated. Have you tried to get the videotapes that were shot in front of the Murrow Building on the date of the attack?
They say they don't exist, is my understanding.
Actually, I know people who've actually got them into court, and they said they couldn't release them because there's an ongoing investigation. But
well, it depends on which day of the week. I mean, most times they'll tell you there are no such
right.
tapes, and they can lie with impunity. I mean, as you pointed out, if you or I or any of your listeners lie to the FBI, it's a felony, and we're prosecuted and sent to prison. Witness Martha Stewart. Government agents not only can lie at will, but they can take the stand and lie.
And because that is what's so really, when an FBI agent is allowed to perjure himself on the stand and nothing is going to be done to him, then forget about our court system. I mean, it must be infuriating to you as a lawyer.
Well, and I know in the trial of my brother's case that they had witness after witness from the government took the stand and lied, and it got so bad that the judge just threw up his hands and said, these people don't understand the significance of an oath.
Well, of course, when we have a country that's taken God out of our schools and God out of our government, should we be surprised that people would take an oath and lie, especially government officials? Now, wasn't one of the prisoners who was there in the prison with your brother when he was being tortured to death, didn't he actually come forward and tell the truth about what happened and what happened to him?
He tried to come forward and tell the truth, and a month before our trial was started, he supposedly hanged himself while in federal custody. So you have my brother supposedly a suicide by hanging, Richard Lee Guthrie supposedly suicide by hanging, and Alden Gillis Baker suicide by hanging, all in isolation cells, all under federal custody, all under the custody of the FBI.
Now, of course, would you ever have a chance to interview this other fellow and record what he had to say?
I did. He said my brother had been beaten and tortured.
And, of course, do you have it on tape or not?
I have a deposition.
Okay, well, and of course, were you allowed to submit that to the court?
I was, but it's not like having a live witness.
I know. But anyway, you did win the case, didn't you? And the government eventually settled the case with you?
No, they didn't. The judge said that because of all the evidence they destroyed, my brother, they undressed him, the FBI did, and threw away his blood-stained clothing before they turned the body over to the medical examiner. They cleaned the cell. All the logbooks that would have shown who came and went in the institution disappeared. And if the ones that didn't disappear, the pages disappeared. All the logbooks. The videotapes were erased. The crime scene photographs disappeared. All the evidence evaporated. And finally, the judge said, this is probably a murder, but you can't prove it because there's nothing left. But he did say, and I think it's probably the only instance in the history of this country where this has happened, he said, based upon the conduct of the United States, Department of Justice, especially the FBI, I'm going to award you $1.1 million for an intentional infliction of emotional distress. It may be the only case in which the FBI has been convicted of intentionally injuring American citizens. And, of course, the government of the United States has told us they would never pay that.
Have they ever paid it?
No. Made us a settlement offer, though.
Beg your pardon?
They made us a settlement offer.
Uh-huh.
The offer was that I personally have to apologize to the FBI and forgive the judgment.
Or else what?
Or they destroy me.
And have they been really going out to get you?
They made at least two attempts I know of to indict me.
Well, you're lucky. I mean, some people have. We have this one, a gentleman we actually have interviewed a number of times, Gary Webb, who's written about the CIA, and he shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. So at least you're still alive, and unfortunately, this sort of thing goes on in America. And when we see this degree of corruption at the highest levels of our government, then no man's life or property or certainly person are really safe. Well, I admire you for sticking in there and trying to get to the truth. So what's the next step now? Are you representing Hammer, and are you trying to get the recorded testimony, recorded conversations between David Paul Hammer and Timothy McVeigh? Do they have those tapes?
Those tapes exist, but they lie and say they don't. What they did is they secretly recorded those conversations. And when you file a request for them, it's easy for them to come back and say there are no such. I mean, that's their standard response. I was fortunate to have been leaked several documents that, so when they lied and said none existed, I had them. In this case, with Hammer's conversations with Tim McVeigh, they simply say that never happened. And you can never prove it.
Well, it sounds to me like that there are people within the Justice Department, within the FBI, within the certainly within the court system, who are trying to get you the information so that you can continue to pursue what you're doing.
I've been very fortunate, sir. I've received anonymously through the mail a lot of help. I've received, when I said the crime scene photographs had disappeared, I suddenly one day shows up in the mail copies of them.
Now, my understanding is that somebody within the coroner's office or somebody had gone over this and said this really was a murder. What was the background of that?
Well, it was the medical examiner from the state of Oklahoma said it was horrible. He'd been threatened. His staff had been threatened. That he thought it was a murder.
I mean, the coroner of the state of Oklahoma had been threatened?
Yes, it reached the point where the Oklahoma Attorney General's office had to intervene against the Reno Justice Department and to keep to stop the threats against the Oklahoma State Medical Examiner's staff. It's an incredible letter, I mean, from the Attorney General saying, you know, you've got to stop threatening these people for doing their job.
And, of course, I wonder what Gianna Reno's response was.
I don't think she ever responded. Well, publicly, she's never responded.
Well, of course, the thing is that here you've got the state a medical examiner saying this is a murder. He gets, in turn, threatened. And of course, were you able to bring that out in court? Was he willing to come to testify when you were pursuing your case?
And shortly before the trial, he reversed himself and said it was a suicide.
In other words, it got to him, huh?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the man, and I wasn't in his shoes, so I don't know what all he went through, but I don't think he's very happy with himself today over.
Well, I think that the great tragedies, we see this, I think, with a lot of the people in the military, a lot of the people in the CIA who know the truth about things that have happened, and most of them are afraid to speak out. And even when they get out of the military, when they get out of government service, they're still afraid to speak out. They don't want to end up like Gary Webb, who shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. Well, what's the next thing as far as trying to get more in the way of information? Because I know you're not going to let this thing go until the people responsible stand before the bar of justice. And how are we going to get the American people to know the truth about the fact that they murdered your brother? They threatened the medical examiner, and whatever they did, they forced him to reverse his position. And of course, even the efforts to get you disbarred. I mean, this is criminal activity. It should be pursued under a RICO statute against the people of the highest echelons of government, and they should be brought before the bar of justice.
Well, I think the irony here is I will probably, because he did such a good job of covering up the murder, never be able to prove they murdered my brother. But I have proven, and someday it will come out, that they did murder the 168 people in Oklahoma City. The one person who's, of all elected officials who's tried to help us, has been Dana Rohrabacher out of Orange County, Congressman Rohrabacher. For years he's tried to help us, and he had planned to conduct hearings in November into the connection of the government with the bombing in Oklahoma City. And I'm not political this way in terms of a party, one party or the other. I think they're all equally bad. But it's my understanding that if the Rohrabacher's Republican, that if the Republicans lose control of the House of Representatives, he's never told me this, but I've heard that they've been told that there will be no hearings.
Well, the thing is that somehow we have to get to the bottom of it. I would think there'd be some Democrats that'd like to get to the bottom of it as well.
It's also political. I mean, the Democrats wouldn't touch it because it would go right back to the Clintons in Reno.
But you would think that now the Republicans are in, they would try to get to the bottom of it. The Republicans have controlled the White House and both houses of Congress for 6 years. They can't say that, you know, there's nothing they could have done.
I think that I had a friend once tell me, and I think it was one of the most brilliant statements I've ever heard, that America is actually a three-party system. You have Democrats, you have Republicans, and you have the permanent party. And the permanent party are the people who run the agencies, who are not elected, who survive from administration to administration and actually run the government. And these are the people who run the FBI, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm Bureau, the Internal Revenue Service. They run the government, not the president, not the Congress.
Well, now we're getting close to the end of the program. Do you have a web page where people can go and get some of this information we've talked about tonight?
I don't, sir, but I could send you the links to the documents so that if you have a web page, you can post them. And I would welcome everybody in this country to go look at those documents.
And are they up on the web someplace?
Yes, and I will send you that link.
If you would, please, I'd appreciate it. And maybe we could just get some of those and put them up on our website, because we've got a lot of people going there. And we want people to understand that this sort of thing really does go on. This is not imaginary. We're dealing, I believe, with organized evil. And that is what it's really all about. We'll be right back to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Jesse, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, what I can say is I agree with your views. We've become too complacent as a society. We've let, under the guise of fighting terrorism and everything else, the government strip us of our liberties, our freedoms. I didn't start out distrusting the government. I started out believing in my government. I started out expecting truth and a modicum of justice from my government. And I've gotten neither. I've gotten nothing but lies and injustice from the government of the United States.
But, you know, I think the most amazing thing is, Jesse, that, at least under certain circumstances, the judicial system works, and the fact that they had to get a whole flock, a stable of different lawyer firms, law firms to come up against you meant that, you know, the judge that was at least willing to be fair, and maybe he couldn't convict the government of murder, but at least the fact that he ordered them to make a settlement with you. Now, is there any way you can pursue that settlement?
No, you can't enforce a judgment against the United States. But I think, you know, sir, that the thing to consider is I was one of the rare, they perhaps picked the worst person in the world, brother, to kill. Who else could have made this fight? Yes, we may have achieved these results, but how many other families would have had, people would have had a brother who was a trial lawyer? How many other people would have had a brother who's an ex-Marine who's hard-headed enough to fight these people to hell freezes over? And they count on the fact that most people don't, and they would steamroll 99.9% of the people that they victimize because they don't have the resources to fight.
Well, I certainly admire your tenacity. I admire the fact that you've been willing to stay in. And of course, this puts them on the defensive. And they've got to spend an awful lot of time and effort trying to keep your story from getting out. And as there are more and more of the truth is coming out, and they have to spend more and more time trying to put out all the little fires, pretty soon I think a lot of these flames, whether it be 911 or TW-800 or Waco or certainly Oklahoma City bombing, all of these little fires are going to come together, and they're not going to be able to put them out. And when the American people begin to understand the dishonesty that exists at the highest levels of our system, maybe they'll begin to connect the dots. That's our anyway, that's my hope, that's my prayer. Jesse Tratidu, thank you so very much for being with us this evening here at Radio Liberty, and I hope we can get you on to some of our other programs real soon.
I appreciate you having me, sir.
Good night. God bless.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Jesse Tratidu. We're going to have open lines the next hour, so if you'd like to call in, I have something you'd like to talk about, fine. But this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. This is not a nice story to tell. I mean, a man being tortured and beaten to death in his cell, and one of the people who witnessed this, a month before he's to go to trial, he's suddenly found hanged, and so many people are found hanged in our prisons. Could this really go on? Yes, it could. Because although we have a lot of fine, certainly moral people working in the system, we have a certain small number of truly demonically possessed people, and there really is organized evil at the highest levels of our government. There are satanic organizations. There are satanic sacrifices in America. And you really need to get some of our material to find out that these people are open in their allegiance and write about their allegiance to Lucifer, the Red Dragon. And you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, or get the video and audio tape. But the book gives you all the sources of reference, so you can check it out and find if it's really true. The book, The Dire of a Devil Hunter, is very good. William Kennedy has a new book out on satanic crimes that we'll be carrying. That's Satanic Crimes by William Kennedy, although we haven't told our exchange about that. We certainly will. And you need to read, for instance, Malachi Martin's book, Hostage to the Devil. Hostage to the Devil. Get my 4-tape set and the book together as the Malachi Martin special. Because at least in one of the interviews, Malachi talks about the satanic ceremony held in the basement of the Vatican, a satanic ceremony where they feigned human sacrifice, a time to coincide with the human sacrifice that was actually taking place elsewhere. And, of course, this comes from a book he wrote called Windswept House, where, of course, it's written as faction, in other words, fact disguised as fiction, but it was really true. And Malachi told me that they really did have the satanic ceremony in the basement of the Vatican. But I'm not picking on the Catholics. They have the same sort of thing. And the Protestant Church, they have the same sort of thing in the Jewish religion. There is an underground of Satanism throughout the world today. And it's very difficult to understand many of the things that are going on unless you understand that, for instance, we have a book called The Diary of a Devil Hunter by a man who was in Satanism. And then the curse came out and went around the world, you know, telling police forces and groups about these satanic organizations and sacrifices. And who's going around after him to say, oh, it doesn't exist? High officials from the FBI. And he even tells you this in his book. And, of course, I've read this in other books written by people who've tried to expose the satanic organizations in America, the FBI. Their purpose is not to expose the satanic movement. It's to conceal it. David Berkowitz. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Keller, was part of a satanic group called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And, of course, Charlie Manson was associated with that. And everything was done to block efforts to expose the truth about that. In fact, they refused to go after the other people in the satanic cult. Captain Jeffrey McDonald, the Green Beret officer, captain of the Green Beret, doctor, physician, who came home one evening and find his wife and children murdered by a satanic cult. And, of course, that information has been covered up. Ted Gunderson actually has recorded a testimony by one of the people who was there, a woman who was part of the satanic cult. And recently, the marshal, 25 years later, a marshal came forward and said, I was there. I brought this woman who confessed she was part of the satanic cult to the prosecutor, and he told the woman if she went on the stand and told the truth, he'd try her for murder. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeffrey McDonald's been in prison for 25 years, Captain Jeffrey McDonald, for a murder he didn't commit because the prosecutor was covering for the satanic cult. They're here. It's real. It's not imaginary. And our job is to get the truth out. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV. War. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Now, for those of you who listen to our programs regularly on shortwave, I just want to mention that we have our afternoon program. They've shifted this from 9.840 to 7.490. That's 7.490. And our evening program is certainly at 5.850 and 5.860. For the first hour, and then it shifts to another frequency for the second hour. So anyway, if you'd like more information, just go to our website and the exact directions of how to get our shortwave programs are there. But we've got a gentleman called Tal, and we're going to talk to him. Hi, he's from Santa Cruz. Hi, Tal, how are you doing?
Hi, this is Tal A.
Right, Tal A. Okay, fine. Yeah. And you're wanted to announce something about the motion picture you're going to have, or the DVD you're going to be showing, dealing with vote scam?
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead, Dr. Stan.
Yeah, my name is Tal A. Laffy Rosalini, and I am resident here in Santa Cruz County. And I saw this film up at the Roxy about a month and a half ago when Mark Crispin Miller, the professor from New York University who wrote Fooled Again, about the theft of the 2004 election, and he introduced the film Stealing America, vote by vote. I was so moved by it that I decided to approach the filmmaker and see about bringing it to Santa Cruz. So we're showing it here tomorrow night, this film by, it's a brand new feature-length documentary by Emmy-winning, Oscar-nominated filmmaker Dorothy Fadiman. It's going to be at the Rio Theater tomorrow night in Santa Cruz at 1205 Soquel Avenue, 7 p.m. tomorrow night, Thursday, November 2nd, right here in Santa Cruz. And this is, I don't know if you know this, but it's the biggest screen or the biggest theater in Santa Cruz County.
All right, fine.
So we can get over 700 people in there. So we're just encouraging everybody to come on out and see this film. It'll really open up your eyes. You want to go in when you're voting with your eyes wide open. And this film really helps you understand what's happening and how our country is really being stolen.
And, of course, the thing is that the electronic voting machines cannot be trusted.
Absolutely.
They're fixed, and basically they fixed them to win the election in Ohio. And many of these, it wasn't just one precinct, but many of the precincts with 500 or 600 people there would have up to several thousand votes for George Bush. How could that be if there are only 400 or 500 people in the precinct? They simply fix this, but people don't want to admit that the elections are rigged in America by electronic voting machines. You can have trouble, certainly, with paper ballots, but at least you have a trail.
Yes, and what's really great about this film is that this film offers a lot of solutions people can things that people can do as citizens to become active and take back our country.
I agree with you.
Little things we can do, big things maybe, but they're for a lot of people, but they're not very difficult.
And I think it's so important that we start stressing over and over again, you can't trust the electronic voting machines. You've got to have a paper trail.
Yes.
You can, and if they have an electronic voting machine and no paper trail, then you go demand, of course, that they, and set up committees in your community.
Well, even with the paper trail, there are problems.
There are always problems, but the electronic voting machines without any paper trail, there's no way to figure out.
I think it's something like 80%, almost 90% of the electronic voting is no paper trail.
Okay, fine. Well, we've got to get back to a paper trail. I appreciate so much your calling.
Just remind people, it's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Rio. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for calling.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Stan. Stealing America, vote by vote.
Stealing America, vote by vote, and I really believe it's going on. Okay, thank you so much. That was Tal A calling from Santa Cruz. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, if you'd like to talk about voting, if you'd like to talk about Oklahoma City, if you'd like to talk about 911, if you'd like to talk about what's going on in this senseless war that we're involved in over in Iraq, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, you know, as we see what's going on in Iraq, I mean, the thing is that why are we trapped in a situation over there? And they say, oh, you can't just leave. If you leave, there's going to be chaos. Well, as long as we stay, there's going to be chaos because the Iraqi people are smart enough to know that we did not go over there to give them freedom. We went over there to install a radical Shia dictatorship, and that's exactly what it is. The Shias are the majority. The Constitution established as a Islamic state under Sharia law. Under Sharia law, there is no freedom. Everything has to be run by the mullahs, and that's what the Constitution is all about. And when we think of the voting in Iraq, we think of the woman wearing the shawl, holding up her ink-stained finger, saying, I voted, I voted. What did she vote for? She voted to establish an authoritarian Islamic dictatorship. And where is the outcry? In fact, we never hear this discussed by anybody, had it not been for my good friend John Stormer, who actually got hold of a copy of the Iraqi Constitution and read the Iraqi Constitution. I certainly wouldn't know what was in it, nor would the average individual. So our job is to let people understand that the voting over there was fraudulent. Oh, I think that probably the majority of the people voted for the Constitution because the majority of the people are Shias. And the majority of the people there really want an Islamic government. And the people who don't, they don't have any rights at all. In fact, the Christians are fleeing the country because they know what life would be like under an Islamic republic. And so what we've done over there is lead to the murder of, well, it's estimated about 600,000 Iraqis have died unnecessarily since we came into the war. Over 2.5 million Iraqis have died since 1991 as a direct result of America's, first of all, encouraging Saddam to attack Kuwait, and then, of course, after the war, putting sanctions on Iraq that killed 500,000 children and 1.5 million Iraqis because of no medical supplies. Well, this is Dr. Stan. It's going to be open lines this hour, and we'll certainly invite your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're simply talking about what's going on in Iraq. And I was pointing out that it's estimated that during the period 1991, following the Iraqi war, the first Gulf War, the war in Kuwait, where we did invade the southern part of Iraq, the sanctions that we imposed upon Iraq led to the death of about 2 million Iraqis. 500,000 of them were children. 1.5 million were Iraqi citizens. Why? Because they couldn't get antibiotics. They couldn't get medicines. They couldn't get anything for 5 or 6 years there. And the people died. I mean, if you could get antibiotics in America, how many people would die? And especially over there in Iraq, with the poor sanitary conditions, especially after we disrupted so much of the country there. And, of course, we did not try to get Saddam out of power. In fact, the president's father, President George Herbert Walker Bush, told the people of Iraq to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein if we would come and help them. And so the Kurds rose up in the north. And the Shia Muslims rose up in the south because they believed President George Herbert Walker Bush. Well, of course, we had no intention of helping them, but now they were enemies of the state. And, of course, we had complete control of the air. The Iraqis were not allowed to have any planes in the air, either southern or northern Iraq. But we allowed them to take their helicopter gunships down and kill the Shia Muslims by the tens of thousands. Why would we have done that? And why would the American president have encouraged the people of Iraq to rise up and overthrow Saddam when we had no intention of going to help them? And, of course, too, we can go back to 1956, the Hungarian Revolution, when, of course, the Hungarians had risen up and had overthrown the communist regime in their country. And we kept beaming in messages, overthrow the communist regime, overthrow the communist regime. We'll come and help you. And we had no intention of coming to help them. We actually aided the communists by encouraging the people to rise up, and then they knew who the traitors were, and they just slaughtered them by the tens of thousands. Why would our State Department have done something like that unintentionally in Hungary? Well, it's very, very simple. Because the United States officials and American corporations and banks had funded communism since its inception. And if you encourage the people to rise up, then you can find out who the traitors are to the country, and then the communists can kill them. And you say, that's absurd. We wouldn't do a thing like that. And yet that's exactly what we did in Hungary. That's exactly what we did in Iraq in 1991. I don't know how many people died, tens of thousands. And then, of course, because of the embargo, it's estimated about 2 million people died in that 10-year period. It's estimated now, since we went into Iraq to liberate the country, up to 600,000 more Iraqis have died than could be anticipated. I know at least 1.8 million Iraqi citizens have fled the country into Jordan and Syria and any other place they can go to get away from the violence that's in Iraq today, a living hell. Now, it didn't have to be that way. That's the problem. And if you analyze what happened in Iraq, it was really an amazing thing, the way the American forces were able to move very, very quickly into Iraq after the shock and awe air attack. And I'm sure that many of the Iraqi military officers and many of the Iraqi soldiers believed the pamphlets that were passed out, that we were sending out leaflets, you know, telling the military officers, you know, if you'll just not have your soldiers fight, why, of course, you will still keep your jobs. We're not here to take over Iraq. We're simply here to replace the wicked Saddam Hussein and stop the weapons of mass destruction that threaten America, and that's the only reason we're coming in. And I'm sure many of the Iraqi officers believe that, and so most of the Iraqi units did not oppose the Americans coming in. The Iraqis simply laid down their arms. They surrendered rather than fight because they felt that all we were there for was just to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And most Iraqis hated Saddam Hussein and the authoritarian society, and they would like to have had a chance for some type of a democratic society similar to ours, where the power of the government was limited and men could be free. But that was not the plan of the people who really controlled our country. The invasion began in mid-May of 2003. And simply within a very, very few weeks, while President Bush landed on an aircraft carrier, well, he didn't really land, somebody flew the plane, but he tried to give that impression, jumping out of the plane in his flight suit as if he'd been at the controls or having something to do with the landing. It's all a matter of perception, ladies and gentlemen. It's all showbiz. And they had a big placard up there. I wonder how many of you remember the aircraft carrier. And the placard said, "Mission accomplished." And the president told the cheering soldiers on board the aircraft carrier that America had defeated Iraq, we'd won the war, the war was over. But of course, the war wasn't over. The president sent J. Paul Bremer to Iraq. Now you have to know a little bit about J. Paul Bremer. He's one of the elite who rule the world. He was close to Henry Kissinger. In the year 2000, he came out with a report called the Bremer Report, we have, and he explained all about the terrorist attack that was coming almost a year and a half before the terrorist attack came to America. And he told how this was going to be handled. He didn't actually say this is how we're going to do, but he starts the report by quoting a book on Pearl Harbor and how it was that, oh my goodness, Pearl Harbor came about, and we had no idea it was going to come. And the basic theme of the quotation that begins the Bremer Report, which is, of course, foretelling the terrorist attack on America, is this. Pearl Harbor came about because we were just so inefficient. Why do you realize that one person in government wouldn't talk to another? that people were afraid to tell their superiors the truth, that there was total breakdown in communication. And I mean, it just gives you this idea that the United States government in 1914, and specifically the military, was just totally incompetent. That isn't true at all. The government knew exactly where the Japanese fleet was. They were tracking them all the way across the Pacific. They even knew the exact moment the attack was going to occur. And they left those soldiers and sailors on Oahu to die. But you couldn't tell the American people that because we needed a slogan to get us into World War II. Remember Pearl Harbor. Remember the speech written by the president about the Day of Infamy. It said that he'd written the speech many weeks before, many days before the attack, because we know that they knew the attack was coming because I have the pages from Secretary of War Simpson's diary. I found them back in Sterling Library at Yale University. And there, of course, the Secretary of War Simpson, who just happened to be a member of Skull and Bones, who just happened to be a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, tells about going to the White House. And George Captain Marshall was there. Secretary of War Frank Knotts was there. Admiral Stark was there, representing the Chief of Naval Operations. There were only four men there and President Roosevelt. And President Roosevelt told them, and this was on November 25th, the Japanese are going to attack. We think it will be next Monday. Of course, that would have been about the 30th of November. And of course, we anticipate that, you know, the whole question is, how will we get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot? That was exactly what Secretary of War Simpson wrote in his diary. How are we going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot? And that's, of course, what it was all about. They needed an incident to mobilize the American people to go to war because the American people didn't want to get involved in another futile European war. I mean, they'd already been tricked into going to World War I by the phony atrocity stories that had been put out by the controlled media, the media controlled by J.P. Morgan and company. And, of course, we have the article out of the Congressional Record written by Congressman Calloway. We'd be glad to send to any of our listeners, where Congressman Calloway tells how J.P. Morgan got together a group of newspaper editors, and they planned on how they could control the media. And they got a list, I think, of 125 newspapers, and they actually limited that down to about 25 newspapers, and they decided if they could control the editorial policy of those 25 newspapers, they could control the news of America. And they bought the editorial policy of those newspapers, and they sent their people to those newspapers to filter and censor the news. And then they began to tell the atrocity stories about the little Belgian boys who had their hands cut off, about the Belgian women who were being raped and had their breasts cut off by the wicked Huns. And day after day, we heard those atrocity stories. Day after day, week after week, month after month, until the American people honestly came to believe them. And they believed something that was a total lie. I'll never forget when I, early on, when I was giving talks, coming to a man who came to one of my meetings and told me that, he'd been one of those idealistic young men who volunteered for the American Expeditionary Force back in 1917 to go to Europe to fight the wicked Huns because they were cutting off the hands of little Belgian boys and the breasts of Belgian women. And, you know, he and his unit fought, you know, all throughout France and up into Belgium. And so many of his boys had died. Many of his friends had died along the way. And when they finally got into Belgium, there weren't any little boys with their hands cut off. And there weren't any women with their breasts cut off or women had been ravaged and raped by the wicked Huns. It was all a lie. And that was, of course, known pretty well. By the time the Second World War came along, and that's why the American people didn't want to go to the Second World War. So they needed an incident, and they called it Pearl Harbor. But what most people don't understand is that Hirohito, the Emperor of Japan, was part of a secret society called the Order of the Garter. And he'd been a member before the Second World War, and he was a member after the Second World War. And of course this had to do with British royalty and this whole complex of royal families and royal blood and the true rulers of the world, and behind them, the dark, sinister spirits of forces. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course it's open lines, and we look forward to hearing from you. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we were simply talking about the Second World War and how they got us into that. And of course, you remember the stories that we had the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We had to go to war, you know, in Vietnam because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, because supposedly a couple of patrol boats had fired at an American destroyer, and it was all a lie. And 58,000 American boys died because of that lie, and nobody's ever been held responsible. And Robert McNamara, who was certainly an important part of that, and incidentally, Robert McNamara is involved in the occult. We have articles from West Magazine to point out that he was certainly going to Marie Strong's occult center with Henry Kissinger, you know, where the witches and the Satanists and all these people have meetings in La Baca Grande in Colorado. That Robert McNamara, we know, is on the board of directors of the World Futurist Society, along with Barbara Mark Subbard, whose book is channeled to her by what I believe is a demonic spirit. She calls it the Christ Spirit. The book, the Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation. Incidentally, when it was actually brought out in the final edition that was available to the public, we have the original edition, but the final edition, why, of course, it was sponsored and financed by the Lawrence Rockefeller Endowment for the Humanities. The Lawrence Rockefeller Endowment for the Humanities, and, of course, Marie Strong. So Marie Strong, Barbara Mark Subbard, who leads the occult movement in America, and Robert Strange McNamara, all of the board of directors of the World Futurist Society, whose emblem, at least until recently, was a circle with three sixes in it. But we shouldn't be surprised. Certainly the emblem logo of the Trilateral Commission is a circle with three sixes joined together by an upside-down broken cross. The logo of the Foreign Affairs magazine, the theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, is a man riding a white horse, very reminiscent of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And we'd love to hear from you, because this is open lines, and we ordinarily do it the first hour, but I did want you to have an opportunity to hear Jesse Tretidome and his story about what happened to his brother. Anyway, of course, we know the America was drawn into the first Gulf War, in large part because of the testimony of a tearful girl who weepingly told members of Congress about how she had personally witnessed the children, little infants, being thrown out of a bassinet by the wicked Iraqi soldiers and of course, left there to die so they could steal the bassinets. Of course, there was no truth to the story at all. She hadn't seen any of the things. She was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. And we kept saying we have to fight for Kuwait to bring democracy, restore democracy. It's always been a feudal monarchy there in Kuwait, and our government knew that, but we can't tell the American people we're fighting to restore a feudal monarchy that had been stealing oil from Saddam Hussein, and that our own ambassador, April Gillespie, had actually encouraged Saddam to invade Iraq. And if you doubt that, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for a copy of the article about when an ally becomes an enemy. When an ally becomes an enemy, we'd be glad to send it to you free of charge. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is Open Lines. We'd like to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And as we were simply pointing out, we were drawn into the Spanish-American War with the slogan, you know, remember the Maine, and of course the idea that, you know, the terrible atrocities committed by the Filipinos. We were drawn into the First World War by the slogan, remember the Lusitania, and of course the atrocity stories of the wicked Huns and their atrocities against the little Belgian boys and the Belgian women. We were drawn into the Second World War by the stories of German and Japanese atrocities, And I'm sure they were really very real. And, of course, the story of the Bataan Death March and of course, the slogan, Remember Pearl Harbor. But what most people don't understand is that all during the Second World War, people in our country were financing the Germans. And that was, of course, there's a wonderful book called Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham, the book which we do carry on Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, covers at least American corporations working for Adolf Hitler, and they were never held as war criminals. In fact, the bombing patterns, when we were bombing Germany, we were hitting the German factories with our bombs, but never the American-owned corporations who were building the war materials for Adolf Hitler, because that would have been, of course, bad for the profits of the Ford Motor Company and International Telephone and Telegraph and General Motors, known as Opel in Europe at the time. And so the bombing patterns were very specific. We bombed the German factories. They're making war materials for Adolf Hitler, but not the American factories. They were making war materials for Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. But what most people don't understand is that our government was actually, and people within our government and within our corporations were actually funding and helping and financing Adolf Hitler and supplying him during the Second World War. And the book would be Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham. And, of course, as far as Japan was concerned, I remember, of course, Hirohito was never punished for war crimes. That's because Hirohito was part of a secret society. Part of the secret society that runs the world today, dating back to the 1400s, the Order of the Garter. And the fact most people have never even heard of the Order of the Garter is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And of course, now we're at war with Afghanistan and we're at war with Iraq because of, well, we're fighting Islamic terrorism. In fact, as the president says, we're far better to fight them on the streets of Baghdad than on the streets of New York. But is he telling us the truth? And I would like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, if we are really at war with Islamic terrorism, why has there not been one major terrorist attack on the United States in over 5 years? Why? If we're really at war with Islamic terrorism, why is it that the federal government refuses to have an adequate watch list at our airports for people? In fact, those of you who saw the CBS documentary, I think it was 2 weeks ago, talk about the watch list, and I've forgotten how many tens or $150 million, something like that, we've invested in the watch list. And, of course, it has names in it like 14 of the hijackers who supposedly died on 9/11 and it is a totally inadequate watch list. The real terrorist names aren't on there, and the names that are on there are people that that are really a no threat to America. Well, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But the one thing is, you would know that if they really believed in Washington D.C. were involved with the war on terrorism, they would have closed the border initially. If they really believed we were involved in a war on terrorism, they would have stopped the catch-and-release program, which involved anybody from an Islamic country that was a terrorist nation who was apprehended crossing our border, would be, fingerprinted and then told to return in a month for a hearing. And do you know that none of them ever came back? Or they say maybe between 5 and 10% of them came back for hearings, and all the rest of them simply disappeared into our country. Now, if you really believed that we were involved in war on terrorism, wouldn't you think that you would deport people from terrorist countries who were coming into our country illegally? And yet they haven't done it. If you read the issue of Foreign Affairs magazine before the latest one, the lead article there on page 2 is Why Haven't They Hit Us Again? And the conclusion there in the theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, whose members run America, is there is no threat from Islamic terrorism. It's all contrived. Because that's just what they tell the elite. They're not going to tell the common people. After all, we're going to send our sons and daughters over there to Iraq to fight and bleed and suffer and die. But they're never going to be allowed to win the war, because they're not trying to train the Iraqi army to take over. They just want the war to continue, just like in Vietnam. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and if you're out there and you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, and we're really talking, well, we're getting around to talking about the war in Iraq, and it just drags on and on and on. We've never sent enough soldiers to do the job. I mean, the military, when they went in, wanted an adequate number of soldiers, and Rumsfeld just refused to give them, and the officers did not have the courage to resign their commissions rather than undertake an attack that they knew would be unsuccessful. They knew that if they were going to have to occupy the country afterwards, why, of course, they're going to have adequate troops. But then they could have done it had they maintained the structure of the Iraqi army. But that was not to be. J. Paul Bremer, who's, of course, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who prepared the Bremer Committee report I mentioned earlier, which, of course, explained exactly what the technique they were going to use to confuse the American people about the coming terrorist attacks. J. Paul Bremer went in as the presidential envoy, and pulling rank on the military officers who wanted, of course, to enlist the help of the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force and the Iraqi civil service and administration, J. Paul Bremer dissolved them all. And then, working in concert with the Defense Department and the Pentagon, blocked efforts to rebuild the Iraqi army. And to this very day, the Iraqi army cannot accomplish anything at all. And certainly there's an article within the last 10 days in the Wall Street Journal pointing out that we sent over officers and a relatively untrained unit of American soldiers, reservists, going to Iraq. None of them speak Arabic. And what's their job? They're to work for the Iraqi army, to help train the Iraqi army. How do you help train an army when you can't speak the language? How can you help train an army when the officers can't communicate with the Iraqi officers? And, of course, the stories that we get, I mean, the equipment is adequate. It's been reported that we'd bought 100,000 rifles for the Iraqi military, and they all disappeared along with the ammunition. Now, how could something like that happen unintentionally? And I would like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, the last thing they want is, of course, a stable Iraq. The last thing they want, of course, is a stable Iraqi army and a stable police force and a stable civil service. They want chaos. That's how they're going to justify our staying there, because that is the plan. And if you doubt that, you need to read the report on the Project for the New American Century website, newamericancentury.org. It's called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They'll tell you the plan is we are to stay there in Iraq indefinitely. And that's what it's all about. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course this is supposed to be open lines, and you're supposed to be calling in, and we do hope that some of you out there will give serious consideration to giving us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and if you have something you'd like to talk about. But basically, I'm simply talking about what's going on over in Iraq today. The war now has been going on since March of 2003, almost 3.5 years, almost as long as the Second World War lasted. We got into the Second World War, it began the 1st of January of 1942, and in 3.5 years, 42, 43, 44, 45, 3.5 years, we'd won the war. I mean, we defeated the Germans. We were on the verge of defeating the Japanese. And 3.5 years after we invaded Iraq, why, of course, things are worse off than they were before. And this is not happening by accident. Our leaders are not stupid. We have very, very brilliant people in positions. I believe that J. Paul Bremer and the people he represents from the Council on Foreign Relations know exactly what they're doing. But there is an invisible government that runs our country that has a different agenda. And it would appear that the next thing they're planning is a war with Iran. Now, I hope it's not true. I know that Bob Chapman, who I have a lot of respect for, says that it's not going to happen. But my gut feeling and information I'm able to glean from what intelligence sources I have is that the plan is for January or February for an attack on Iran. Today we have a large NATO naval force off the coast of Lebanon, there on the west coast of Lebanon. Why would we have a large naval force in the NATO naval force in the Mediterranean? And, of course, we'll have American as well as NATO naval forces there. And then we have another gigantic naval task force in the Persian Gulf, just off the shores of Bahrain, and they're going to be beginning their naval exercises and practice loading, stopping vessels and searching them. They're going to be starting that, I think, probably today or tomorrow. And why would we be doing that, you know, right adjacent to Iran when, you know, there's this threat America is going to attack Iran. It's almost like we're trying to provoke Iran to do something to America. And it's almost as if the Iranians are doing everything they can to accomplish exactly the same thing. And none of this makes sense unless there is a master plan that is progressively drawing the United States into an expanded war in the Middle East. And it all goes back to what happened on 9/11, because the American people really didn't want to go to war. I mean, how many Americans wanted to get involved in a war before the 9/11 attack? None of them. In fact, you go back and you can, you know, you can read the writings of Condoleezza Rice, and actually there's a book that's been put out by, it's called Without Precedent. It's written by Thomas Keane and Lee Hamilton, both members of the Council on Foreign Relations, the chairman and the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission. Lee Hamilton was not only CFR, he was Trilateral Commission, and then, of course, of the remaining, there were 10 people on the commission. Initially, four of them, Jamie Grolick, I believe it was her name anyway, John Lehman, Lee Hamilton, and Thomas Keane were members of the Council on Foreign Relations, as was Philip Zelikow, who is the executive director, a personal friend of Condoleezza Rice. How could you possibly have an impartial investigation when you have a personal friend, a man who has written a book with Condoleezza Rice, handling the function of the 9/11 Commission and, suppressing information which would allow the American people to know the truth? And then, of course, there was one man on the 9/11 Commission. His name was Senator Max Cleland. And, of course, he was a triple amputee. He had lost his Senate seat, and he was put on the 9/11 Commission. And he wanted to get to the bottom of it. He wanted to get to the truth. And so they got him off the commission, and they replaced him with Senator Bob Kerry, who, of course, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So five of the 10 members of the commission come from the Council on Foreign Relations. The executive director comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. So there are 11 people, 10 commissioners, the executive director, 11, and, of course, six of them come from the CFR, one from the Trilateral Commission. Do you honestly think that this would be an impartial commission to get to the bottom of what was going on? And despite the fact that, you know, they took testimony from 1,200 people, and most of the testimony was never revealed publicly, was never printed or published, and was sealed for 30 years, despite that, there were some truths that came out. And certainly in the book Without Precedent, which has been published recently by Thomas Keane and Lee Hamilton, they tell you what Condoleezza Rice said. And Condoleezza was asked, you know, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you go after Al-Qaeda? And she said, in essence, well, the American people weren't ready. The American people wouldn't have gone along with going after Al-Qaeda. There had to be a catastrophe. If we were going to get people to change their mind, to change their culture, to change their attitude towards government surveillance, there had to be a catastrophe before it would get the people to change their mind, to change their culture, to change their attitude towards government surveillance. So that comes from page 181 of the 180, I'm sorry, of the book, Without Precedent. It's quoted in my latest newsletter. And you can get it and read it. And then, of course, Donald Rumsfeld, when he was asked why they weren't doing anything, he said, well, this comes from page 161, I believe it is. Donald Rumsfeld said, well, we were really trying to come up with a plan for Al-Qaeda. We'd been working on it. In fact, we completed the plan on the 10th of September. Ladies and gentlemen, what do you think the chances are that they've been working on a plan to go after Al-Qaeda for 6 or 7 months, and just the day before the September 11th attack, on September 10th, they finished the plan? What is the plan? Exactly what they did. They had to have an incident to justify going in. Of course, if you read Bob Woodward's explanation in his latest book, State of Siege, you'll find out it's all cover-up. It's all to give you the impression, oh, we're just so incompetent, nobody knows what's going on. And Bob Woodward's book would not have come out at this time if it had not been a cover for the idea that this was basically an attack by, 19 Islamic hijackers. But the truth of the matter is, you've never heard the truth of the matter. The government is covering this up, first of all, the makeup of both the Joint Intelligence Inquiry and the 911 Commission, controlled by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. This little clique that is an offshoot of Cecil Rhodes' secret society was created to bring about a world government back in 1891, and this is all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or, of course, Professor Quigley's treatise, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and the relationship between the Council on Foreign Relations and the Roundtable Group, which is an offshoot of the Cecil Rhodes Secret Society, is covered on pages 951 and 952 of Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is available through Radio Liberty. Well, under any circumstances, the purpose of the investigations, both of which were censored by the President, the purpose of the investigations was to conceal the truth from the American people. And I'm going to tell you a few of the things we found out recently that make me totally convinced that 19 hijackers did not, hijack those planes and fly them into the buildings, as we've been told. Now, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And one of the best things I've read recently is of, in all places, Vanity Fair magazine. And the article actually was written by a fellow who actually interviewed the people at NORAD, where, of course, they have the control of the military aircraft. And they were in control of military aircraft on the morning of 9/11. And, of course, when the reports came in about the initial hijacking of American Flight 11, why, of course, they thought that this was part of the military exercise that was carried out that morning. And if you read both the Joint Inquiry Report and the 9/11 Commission Report, both of them specifically avoid the fact that there were military exercises taking place that morning that simulated hijackings of planes, and that this information was concealed from the American people. In fact, the 9/11 Commission report accused the military officers of lying and deceiving the commission about the military timeline. The issue was not the military timeline. The issue was the military exercises were held that morning that simulated hijackings. Now, what you do not know and you've never been told is that after Flight 11, we're told, had crashed into the North Tower, Flight 11 continued flying, and the transponder reports actually kept coming in as Flight 11 winged its way towards Washington, D.C. Now, were these just being planted on the screens, the radar screens? I don't know. But somebody was simulating Flight 11, American Flight 11, after it had crashed into the building, as it flew, and they could track its flight path towards Washington, D.C. Do you honestly believe Osama bin Laden did that somewhere in a cave? No, obviously this was a very, very sophisticated intelligence operation. And, of course, one of the other things fascinating is that the officer in charge, of course, immediately ordered the planes into the air, from Otis Air Force Base, and they flew at supersonic speeds directly towards New York. Well, then, of course, the officer in charge of NORAD asked them to put the planes from Langley. There were two fighter planes, armed fighter planes at Langley, not at Andrews Air Force Base, 2 miles away from Washington, D.C., but they were at Langley, and the officer at Langley refused to put the planes in the air. Later, when he was asked why he didn't put them in the air, his explanation was, well, they might have run out of fuel. They might have run out of fuel, and then they'd have to land. And, of course, that isn't true. There are tanker planes up there all the time, and you simply put in a call, you get refueled, and you continue with your mission. But what is even more interesting is that when they finally did plant those planes from Langley up, and Langley is just a little about 100 miles away from Washington, D.C., instead of sending them directly to Washington, D.C. at supersonic speed, as they had with the planes from Otis Air Force Base, they sent them out over the Atlantic Ocean at subsonic speed. And at the time that remember, Langley was just 100 miles away from Washington, D.C., at the time that planes hit the Pentagon, or whatever hit the Pentagon, why, they were 150 miles away from Washington, D.C. They were further away from Washington, D.C. than when they began, and they were flying at subsonic speed. Now, why would that happen? Somebody is not telling us the truth. Well, we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, hi, Stan. Yeah, you got my fascination up when you were talking about the attack on Pearl Harbor and how the government basically pleaded stupidity as to, you know, how it happened without, you know, how they got taken by surprise, et cetera.
Right.
You know, it worked once. I guess they might as well do it again in New York, 60-some years later, but...
And that's exactly what they did. In fact, if you read the Bremer Committee report, and we actually have it, you'll see that what he is talking about in that report that was published in the year 2000 is exactly the scenario that they brought forward after the 9-1-1 attack. Oh, we're just so incompetent. You know, the FBI couldn't talk to the CIA, and the CIA couldn't talk to the FBI, and you know, said the head of the FBI said he was trying to tell John Ashcroft, and John Ashcroft said he didn't want to hear about it, and John Ashcroft said, I never said that, and they're arguing back and forth, and of course George Tenet claims that he told everybody we were at war, but nobody ever heard it. Here's a fellow who's the head of the CIA, he's announcing we're at war with bin Laden back in 1998, and nobody in the entire CIA knows we're at war with bin Laden.
Yeah.
I mean, come on now, do you really expect that? He talks about this emergency meeting he had with Condoleezza Rice, and she doesn't even remember it. And it's all part of a pattern to confuse us. They know exactly what they're doing. They're playing games with our mind.
Well, you were talking also about how do you get your imaginary enemy to fire the first shot so you can get the second shot, et cetera, and the third and the fourth and the fifth. Well, put the gun in their hand and tie a string to their finger and walk away 10 paces and pull a string. You know, they're forced into it whether they like it or not.
Well, the thing is that we do not know exactly what happened that morning, but we do know that there were military exercises that simulated hijackings, and somebody was planting all sorts of false images up on the screen, including American Flight 11 that crashed into the North Tower, continued flying after that, at least according to the radar screens. Who was doing it? It was done intentionally and purposely and maliciously. And actually, at one time, they were tracking 26 hijacked planes. They couldn't figure out anything because everything was done to confuse the people at NORAD.
One thought just crossed my mind. There's obviously something going on with the transponder for Flight 11. Maybe the transponder was actually in that great big white unmarked four-engine jet that was flying around in the sky way up high. Obviously, you know, I just believe the puppet masters were in that plane watching down on the ground to see how well their best laid plans were being carried out.
Well, I think they did a magnificent job, but what they've really done is they overplayed their hand. If they hadn't taken down Building 7, that day, I think they might have gotten away with it, but there's no way you can see Building 7 come down without realizing that there were explosives in that building. It was a controlled demolition.
Well, people to this day are still, you bring up the whole subject to them, and they go, what's Building 7?
Well, that's our job, is to get that information out. And, of course, the story of the passport. Those are the three things that I like to emphasize. I'm not going to argue. The Twin Towers, I believe that they were probably brought down by a controlled demolition, but we cannot prove that. But I don't think anybody would see the pictures of Building 7 come down and realizing this was not hit by a plane. And the whole base of the building explodes, and the building collapses in its own shadow. That is a controlled demolition. That and the story of the passports, there's no way the passports could have ended up on the street next to the North Tower unless it had been planted there. And the other passport, of course, on the Pennsylvania site. Somebody was planting those passports And, of course, they did not make him up that morning. They know who is supposed to be on those planes, and they were building a myth for the American people to believe in. And if they would lie to us about any one thing, we cannot believe anything else they're told. They needed an incident to get us into the war, and September 11th was that incident.
And then, as the dust settles, they have the biggest excuse in the world for revamping the entire CIA, FBI, and national security, and they pull up this Homeland Security number on us. So everybody is very happy that they're going to spend all this money. Like, we really need to have the CIA be more efficient.
And don't forget about the Patriot Act. Don't forget about the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And, of course, you're referring to the Office of Homeland Security Act. More recently, of course, we have the Military Commissions Act. And then another one that, of course, does waive the posse comitatus just within the last week. All of this goes back to 9-1-1. That's why, Mike, we've got to get the truth about what happened that day.
Yeah.
And we'll be back here. You hang on. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Mike, we've got 3 minutes. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, one last thought. All that, what we just talked about, to make sure that none of us rise up and do anything against the government.
Well, our job is, of course, to get the American people to understand that they've lied to us, that what happened on September 11th was carefully staged, and this was an intelligence operation. I don't suggest that George Bush had anything to do with this, but I think he knows it's an intelligence operation. Why, after 9-1-1, instead of firing George Tenet for incompetence, why did he go to the CIA and congratulate George Tenet for a job well done when there are almost 3,000 Americans dead? Who lost their job at the FBI? Who lost their job at the CIA? Nobody lost their job. So obviously they knew, and this thing was an intelligence operation. There's nobody else, of course, who would have planted those images on the radar screens that morning. There's nobody else who could have concealed the fact that there were military operations going on that morning that simulated hijackings. Now, how many there were? Some people say there were 3. Some people say there were 5. Some people say there were 15. I don't know. But I'm sure there were at least 3 of them going on simultaneously. And I know that anybody who's talked about it, like a gentleman we had on a program recently named L.J. Savez, who actually wrote a letter to the newspaper in Cincinnati, and he was in the military that day, and he talked about the military exercises. He talked about seeing something on somebody's desk that was talking about an attack on the World Trade Center that day, and he also talked about the fact that they'd changed the chain of command on how the Air Force would react if there was a hijacking of a plane, and no longer was it automatic that planes would go up to intercept them. Now they had to go directly through the chain of command right after Donald Rumsfeld. And, of course, after coming out and writing that, of course, that letter, he lost his job. He's been threatened, and L.J. Chavez will not even answer his phone at the present time. Why would you threaten people unless they were getting information out that you didn't want to get out? And, unfortunately, this sort of thing happens today in America. Jimmy Walters, a multimillionaire who spent a lot of money on ads in New York City to try to get the American people to think, has had his life threatened so many times he had to leave his home in Santa Barbara and move overseas. Can these things happen in America, Mike? I fear that they can. Anything else, Mike?
Oh, that's enough.
Good night.
Thanks,
God bless. Thanks very much. Okay, fine. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. And of course, next time we have an Open Lines program, we're looking forward to hearing from you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really, quite frankly, do need your help to maintain the outreach that we have across America. So if you believe in what we're doing, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and join the Radio Liberty family of supporters or subscribe to our newsletter. We do hope many of you will get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and come to understand the spiritual aspect of what's going on. We put together a whole flock of great new 4-tape sets. the changing church, going into the church growth movement, the great apostasy that's actually traveling around the world, taking people away from the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Rick Warren's Global Peace Plan, and we're, of course, getting that book. We have a number of books on this. And who's driving the purpose-driven church, deceived on purpose, the dark side of the purpose-driven church, Rick Warren's Peace Plan. And then, of course, a four-tape set on the impending police state. They're planning on having a dictatorship here. A four-tape set entitled Medical Myths and What You Need to Know. A tape set called The North American Community and the Coming National, the Demise of National Sovereignty. The Truth About the Holocaust. That's really one of my favorites, a very important one. These are all tape sets. We have so many tape sets. Do you think you really know what happened with the O.J. Simpson trial? Did you ever wonder why the prosecutor would have asked O.J. to put on a pair of gloves if she didn't know that they were going to fit him? Why did they give Johnny Cochran the ability to say, if the gloves don't fit, you've got to acquit? Was there another sinister plan behind the O.J. Simpson trial? Why did they cancel radio and television programs all across America for weeks and focus our attention on the O.J. Simpson trial? Why did they put a picture of O.J. Simpson on the front cover of Time magazine with his skin darkened so it would look very black? And, of course, O.J. Simpson was a very light-skinned black man. Why did they do it? Who would have benefited from this trial? And who would have benefited from killing Nicole Simpson? Well, anyway, of course, we give you an entirely different picture of what this was really all about in our four-tape set, O.J. Simpson. And of course, we have four tape sets on the Bohemian Grove. We actually have a great video on the Bohemian Grove put out by Alex Jones. We have a four tape set on Skull and Bones. We have a four tape set on secret societies and on the secret government. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope many of you will go to our website and note that we do carry the Berkey products, the Berkey filters, and we have health products and the other things that do help us, at least to some extent, to, finance what we're doing. But we do hope that you want to join in and certainly help us. We're trying, of course, to reprint Dr. Dennis Cuddy's wonderful book, Secret Records Revealed, and we put an index in it. We've actually brought it up to date with an epilogue, and you can get a full case of Dr. Cuddy's books. That's a full case of Dr. Cuddy's book under the same circumstances as we offered with my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. So if you're interested in helping, Chris, making a pledge to take a case of books, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If we get the support, we'll get that book and many of Dr. Cuddy's other books back in print. They will help us to reach people across America. And then, of course, your job is to tell people out there about my ministry and get them to go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com and start pulling down our newsletters. And, of course, certainly you can see many of our videos free up on the Internet and on the Google websites. And you can just punch in Iraq, the Untold Story, or Brotherhood of Darkness. We put them up there because we want you to see them, and then we want you to get other people to see them. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you once again, may the Lord be with you.